Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. It's time to practice your American English skills. Today we have two stories for you. First, we turn to Ethiopia. There is concern that the government there is taking steps against independent media and journalists. Some say the problem is serious. Then an unusual story about U.S. lawmakers and their invitation to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to speak before the U.S. Congress. There is something important you can learn from both these items, and you can practice American English reading and speaking at the same time. So let's get started. An international rights group is accusing the government in Ethiopia of systematically suppressing media before the country's elections in May. Human Rights Watch released a report on the subject recently. The report shows how the Ethiopian government has restricted independent reporting since 2010. Christopher Cruz has more.
Felix Horn is a researcher for Human Rights Watch. He says the government has taken actions against independent journalists who have different opinions than the government. He says after the reporters write stories critical of the government, officials harass them. He says government and security officials threaten the reporters on the phone or through messages on their cell phones or in person. He says the officials are trying to convince the reporters to write stories that give only the government's views on issues.
The next level is threats and harassments against family members, quite often arbitrary detention, to intimidate and to pressure the journalist into censoring their writing. If that doesn't work, the next step seems to involve criminal charges.
The new Human Rights Watch report is called Journalism is Not a Crime. It says 22 journalists, bloggers, and publishers faced criminal charges, and more than 30 journalists fled Ethiopia. Most of those charged were accused of violating a widely criticized anti-terrorism declaration. Human Rights Watch says the repression described in the report is leading to self-censorship. Some Ethiopian journalists are now refusing to report on some issues. The rights group adds that citizens and lower-level government officials are afraid to talk to reporters because they believe the government will punish them. Felix Horn says the repression has led to a reality where only positions of Ethiopian officials or the government are discussed in the media.
It is crucial and critical that there be a vibrant and flourishing independent media that can contribute to the political discourse and the political dialogue within the country, that can provide critical information and critical analysis about the political issues of the day. But sadly, given the decimation of private media that we've seen since 2010, that's just not happening.
Ethiopia's ruling party has governed the country since 1991. It won more than 99% of the votes in the 2010 elections. The opposition won just one seat in parliament. Getachew Reda is a special advisor to Ethiopia's prime minister. In his words, HRW lost their credibility a long time ago, even by their own supporters. So there is no point for us to respond to their remarks. He said journalists who have been detained are jailed because they are guilty of a crime. In his words, You can be anything, a journalist or pretending to be a journalist. But being involved in criminal activity is still a crime, and they will be held responsible. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Ethiopian government to release imprisoned journalists and bloggers and to amend the anti-terrorism measure. I'm Christopher Cruz.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. American officials have announced that President Barack Obama will not meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he visits Washington in March. The U.S. Congress has asked the Israeli leader to speak to a joint meeting of the House of Representatives and the Senate. House Speaker John Boehner said he did not contact the Obama administration about the visit before inviting Mr. Netanyahu. Many observers see the invitation as a way for Republican Party lawmakers to criticize the administration's policy toward Iran. Katie Weaver explains what this means.
President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu do not agree on the best way to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Mr. Netanyahu has questioned Mr. Obama's support of international talks to limit Iran's nuclear activities. With the nuclear talks set to restart in February, some U.S. congressional leaders also are growing impatient. House Speaker Boehner surprised many by inviting the Israeli leader to speak to Congress, as he said, about the threats of Iran's nuclear program and Islamic extremists.
I did not consult with the White House. The Congress can make this decision on its own. I don't believe I'm poking anyone in the eye. There is a serious threat that exists in the world.
A presidential spokesman said Mr. Obama will not meet with Mr. Netanyahu because of Israeli elections, which are set for later in March. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi also questioned the timing of the visit.
This presentation will take place within 2 weeks of the election in Israel. I don't think that's appropriate for any country.
Secretary of State John Kerry sought to play down what many see as congressional criticism of President Obama.
We welcome the Prime Minister of Israel to come and speak in America anytime. And obviously, it's a little unusual to learn of an invitation from the Speaker's office.
Representative Pelosi says the president has a plan to keep Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. She also says Congress needs to hold off on proposed votes to take new steps designed to punish Iran.
It may or may not succeed, but we cannot have it fail because Congress wants to flex its muscle unnecessarily.
But Senator Robert Menendez, a leading Democratic Party lawmaker, disagrees.
Iran needs to know that there will be consequences for failure. Now, some of us believe those consequences should be additional sanctions.
Steve Billett is with George Washington University. He says Congress has a part in shaping U.S. foreign policy. But, he says, congressional involvement could make efforts to negotiate a diplomatic settlement more complex.
I'm not quite sure how all this plays out when it comes to the negotiations. It's clearly a confounding variable for the people who are involved in the negotiations to have these particular issues overhanging the negotiation.
The foreign secretaries of the European Union, Germany, France, and Britain wrote a piece for the Washington Post newspaper. It said, any additional restrictions on Iran now would harm international efforts at a critical moment. The officials appealed to everyone to give diplomacy a chance. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The pomegranate is one of the oldest known fruits. Pomegranates are found in ancient writings and pictured in the ancient art of many cultures and religions. The pomegranate is also a symbol of health, fertility, and long life. Experts think the pomegranate is native to northern India, Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan. Today, it also grows in Southeast Asia, the Western U.S., Armenia, and parts of Africa, among other places. The skin of a pomegranate is strong. It can be red, purple, or orange-yellow. The inside is filled with beautiful dark red seeds that shine like rubies. It is not easy to get them out, but the reward is great. The pomegranate grows on trees. Parts of the pomegranate tree and fruit are used to make medicine. The pomegranate is used for many conditions. However, the U.S. National Institutes of Health says there is not enough scientific evidence to rate pomegranates as effective for any of them. Still, in traditional medicine, the pomegranate is used for conditions of the heart and blood vessels, including high blood pressure and hardening of the arteries. The jewel-like seeds of the pomegranate are loaded with many nutrients and chemicals called antioxidants. These antioxidants remove poisons from the body. The antioxidants found in pomegranates may help remove buildup of damage in blood vessels. So it is a very heart-healthy fruit. Antioxidants slow the progression of age-related sickness and may slow the growth of cancer cells. Men who have prostate cancer may benefit from a daily serving of pomegranate juice. Pomegranates are used for weight loss and used as a treatment for sore throat. Pomegranates are also high in vitamin K, phosphorus, magnesium, calcium, zinc, and iron. Let's just say pomegranates are loaded with great things for the inside of your body. But let's not forget the outside, too. Pomegranates are great for the skin. They protect the skin by encouraging new skin growth, healing wounds, and repairing tissue. Pomegranates protect the skin against sun damage as well. They may help skin look younger by providing moisture and elasticity. Fresh pomegranates are only available in the United States from September to January. They can keep or remain good to eat in the refrigerator for about 2 months if kept in a plastic bag. I'm Anna Mateo. Thank you.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President Abraham Lincoln led the Union of Northern States in 4 years of civil war against the Southern Confederacy. But he did not live to see the end of the war. He did not live to see the nation reunited. He was assassinated in April of 1865. This week in our series, Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell what happened after Lincoln died.
Almost immediately, officials began planning details of the president's funeral. They asked Mrs. Lincoln where she wanted her husband buried. At first, she said Chicago. That was where the Lincolns were going to live after they left the White House. Then she said the Capitol building in Washington. A tomb had been built there for America's first president, George Washington, but it had never been used. Finally, she remembered a country cemetery they had visited. At the time, her husband had said, "When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." So Mrs. Lincoln decided that the president's final resting place would be in the quiet, beautiful Oak Ridge Cemetery outside their hometown of Springfield, Illinois.
For several days after Lincoln's assassination, his body lay in the East Room of the White House. The room was open to the public all day. Next, the body was taken to the Capitol building. Again, the public could come to say goodbye. Then the body was put on a special train for the trip back to Illinois. 4 years earlier, President-elect Lincoln had traveled by train from Illinois to Washington. He stopped to make speeches in cities along the way. Now, on this sad return trip, the train stopped at those same cities: Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Chicago.
In every town, people lined the railroad. They stood silently with tears in their eyes as the train moved slowly past. Farmers working in the fields saw the train and dropped to their knees in prayer. For the wise man who had led the Union through 4 years of bloody civil war, Father Abraham, was dead. Churches throughout the country held memorial services. Ministers told their people that God had taken Lincoln because the president had completed the job God had given him. He had brought peace to the Union and freedom to all men.
The final service was at the cemetery outside Springfield. It ended with the words from Lincoln's second inaugural speech: "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations."
While the nation mourned Lincoln's death, federal officials investigated his assassination. The man who had shot Lincoln in Ford's Theater was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. He had fled the theater after the murder. The government offered a reward of $100,000 to anyone who captured Booth and his helpers. The investigation produced the names of several people who were friends of Booth. One was John Surratt. Like Booth, he supported the Southern Confederacy during the Civil War. Another was David Herold, a young man who worked in a store in Washington. Others were George Atzerodt, Louis Paine, Sam Arnold, and Michael O'Loughlin. Most of these men had stayed at a house owned by John Surratt's mother, Mary.
One by one, in the days following Lincoln's death, these people were arrested. Anyone else who might have had a part in the plot was seized. Soon, hundreds of suspects were being held in jails in and around Washington. At the end of a week, only two of the plotters were still free, David Herold and John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he jumped from the presidential box to the stage at Ford's Theater. A few hours later, he and Herold stopped at the home of a Dr. Samuel Mudd. They reportedly gave the doctor false names. They asked him to fix Booth's broken leg. Dr. Mudd agreed, and he let the two men sleep at his home. Federal troops chasing the assassins arrested the doctor. They accused him of being part of the plot.
John Wilkes Booth and David Herold ran and hid for 6 days. They crossed the Potomac River from Maryland into Virginia. Finally, 12 days after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, soldiers found the two men. They were hiding in a tobacco barn near the town of Port Royal. Herold agreed to surrender. He came out of the barn with his hands in the air. He shouted again and again that he was innocent. Booth refused to come out. The soldiers set fire to the barn.
The fire forced Booth to move close to the door. The soldiers could see him now. He was aiming a gun at them. The soldiers had been ordered to capture Booth alive, but one of them raised his gun and shot Booth in the neck. The actor fell. Some of the soldiers ran to the burning barn and pulled him out. They carried him to a nearby house. He died 2 hours later.
John Wilkes Booth carried a notebook. He wrote in it every day. On the day Lincoln was killed, he wrote, "For 6 months we had worked to kidnap Lincoln, but with the Confederacy being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done. I struck boldly." Booth described how and why he had shot the president. "Our country," Booth wrote, "owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment." Booth's body was returned to Washington. Men who knew him confirmed that it was the body of John Wilkes Booth. The body was buried under the stone floor of the Washington prison. A few years later, his family received permission to move the body to a cemetery in the city of Baltimore.
Evidence showed that only a few people were actually involved in the plot against the president. Most had agreed to work with Booth because they believed he planned to kidnap Lincoln, not kill him. Of the hundreds of persons arrested, only 8 were brought to trial. The Secretary of War decided that they would be tried by a military court. He argued that Lincoln had been commander-in-chief of all military forces and had been murdered during wartime.
The trial began almost 2 months after the assassination. The prisoners seemed in poor condition. All wore heavy chains on their arms and legs, and the men had been forced to wear thick cloths over their heads. Officials said the cloths were necessary to prevent them from talking to each other. The Secretary of War announced that the prisoners could not meet privately with their defense lawyers. They could meet only in the courtroom. Guards could hear everything they said. One of the defense lawyers recognized that the job was hopeless. He said the trial was a contest between the defense lawyers and the whole United States. There was no question, he said, what the military court's decision would be.
The government tried to prove that Lincoln's assassination was a Confederate plot. Witnesses told how Confederate supporters reportedly planned to cause trouble in the North. But none could prove that Confederate President Jefferson Davis, or any other Southern leader, played a part in Booth's plot to kill Lincoln. 400 witnesses appeared. Many of the important ones had been arrested as suspects. They agreed to give evidence if the government dropped the charges against them. For 6 weeks, the court heard evidence against the 8 prisoners. The prisoners themselves could say nothing. They could only listen.
In late June 1865, the trial of Abraham Lincoln's assassins ended. The military officers serving as judges met secretly for 2 days. Then they announced their decision. All 8 prisoners were found guilty. One received a prison sentence of 6 years. 3 were sentenced to life in prison. 4 were sentenced to die. Defense lawyers appealed for mercy. The appeal was on July 7th. David Herold, Louis Payne, George Atzerodt, and Mary Surratt were hanged for the murder of Abraham Lincoln.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.